welcome to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am the Reverend Tracy Springberry. I use the pronouns she and her. And I am delighted to serve this warm, justice-seeking congregation. You are welcome here, no matter who you are, where you came from. This is your first day. If you've been coming for 50 years, you are welcome here no matter how you feel this morning. If you are sad and down and living in this gray world we now inhabit, or if there are so many things that spark joy in your heart, you are welcome here. You're welcome here whether you are a newborn person or you are in your late 90s. You are welcome here. So I just wanted to particularly welcome everybody who's new and to let you all know that on the back of your seats and in the little cards is a place that you can use a QR code to see our order of service and to see our announcements. And they'll come up and there are web pages and you can look at those after service. There are so many ways to get engaged in our community and those are in the announcements. You can really see lots of ways to engage with us. There's coffee service after the service downstairs and also online. If you've got an email and your order of an email, at the top of that email is the link to online coffee service. If you're here in the sanctuary, please put your phones on airplane mode. That helps after you've gotten your order of service and everything. That helps the people at home get more bandwidth. So helpful. So we are still in a pandemic, which is shocking. And we are really recommending that everyone wear masks, and I see that that's in fact true, that most people are wearing masks. So I truly appreciate, because that's one way we care for one another. If it's absolutely essential that every single person, including the children, have masks on, then we have the coffee room downstairs where everyone will be masked for the whole service, till right after the service. And I know some people aren't comfortable with eating and drinking around others, but would like to socialize. So Forest Hall is that space for everyone after the service, if that's your situation. So this is the moment that I would like everyone to greet each other. Say welcome and hello, and greet people you've never met before. You may continue these conversations downstairs after the service. So our opening hymn this morning is known as the African National Anthem. It was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite hymns. It was originally a poem by James Weldon Johnson and set to music by his brother, John Rosamond Johnson. And I think they were Jewish. And it was sung by a group, the first time it was sung was by a group of black children at a segregated school in Jacksonville, Florida, to honor Booker T. Washington. We sing it today to honor the work by black people and so many others for civil rights in our country. Oh, 149, lift up your voice and sing. And there it is. You may rise.
Rejoicing rose, fire the listening.
We light the chalice this morning for the hot flame of justice that burns in Unitarian Universalism, our belief, founded in our belief that all are worthy, every person is worthy and deserves the opportunity to flourish. Let us say our affirmation together. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our minds to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors.
Good morning again. Whoops.
Good morning again.
I'm Salima Malson. I use the pronouns she and her, and it is my privilege to be your lay leader this morning. The chosen words for our opening reading are from the Reverend Hope Johnson. We are one, a diverse group of proudly kindred spirits, here not by coincidence, but because we choose to journey together, learning to love our neighbors, learning to love ourselves, apologizing and forgiving with humility, being forgiven through grace, creating the beloved community together. We are one. We're going to sing together Spirit of Life.
I would like to invite any children who would like to come forward for our story this morning. We have a few seats available up here if you're interested. So our story this morning is Skin Again by Bell Hooks, who is a really well-known Black American writer and thinker, and it's illustrated by Chris Raschka. The Skin Again by Bell Hooks. The skin I'm in is just a covering. It cannot tell my story. The skin I'm in is just a covering. If you want to know who I am, you have got to come inside and open your heart wide. The skin I'm in looks good on me. It will let you know one small way to trace my identity. But then again, the skin I'm in will always be just a covering. It cannot tell my story. If you want to know who I am, you have got to come inside. Be with me inside the me of me, all made up of stories, present, past, and future. Some true to life and others all fun and fantasy, all the ways I imagine me. You can find out all about me, coming close and letting go of who you think I am. Before you come inside and let me be real, and you become real to me. All real then, in the place where skin is one small way to see me, but not real enough to be all. The me of me or the you of you, for we are all inside, made up of real history, real dreams, and the stuff of all we hope for when we can be all real, together on the inside.
Admittedly, these masks are a little troublesome. But we're wearing them for each other, and that's what's important. So now is the time in our service when we take a few minutes to settle back and consider that wonderful infinity symbol of gratitude and giving. There's a lot going on in the world that makes us upset, that makes us angry, that makes us anxious. And still, there is so much to be grateful for. Martin Luther King said at one time, "Real appreciation must flow from the deep seas of the heart." Let's just take a moment, maybe close our eyes, relax, and bring to mind something that we're really grateful for this morning. And then, as we prepare to receive our offering, the offering that comes in a basket, the one that involves probably paper money, let us also take a moment to consider why it is that we give. What is our giving about? Sure, the money that comes in the basket helps to keep the doors open, keeps the lights on. But it does so much more. Mostly, it represents our caring for each other. So when the basket comes, take it in your hands and hold it just for a second. Whether you put anything in or not is irrelevant. You have much to give, and it comes from your heart. And we gladly accept it. all of it. Again, thank you for your generous offerings this morning, whether they're in the basket or whether you're holding them in your heart. Let us speak together our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others.
There is so much happiness in this world. Good relationships, singing, a generous congregation when we don't always have everything completely lined up, facing and overcoming our fears. Together here, we create a circle of celebration, deep enough to hold all the joy in our lives. There's also so much pain in this world. There's oppression, cruelty, war, and illness. Together here, we create a circle of compassion wide enough to hold all the sorrow in our lives. Take a moment of silent reflection. And when the music begins, please come forward if you feel moved to do so and place a stone in the bowl of water. The water is the community of compassion that bears all sorrows. The water is the community of celebration that shares all joys. If you do come up front, we like come up this aisle and return that way. Thank you. So we will sing 1013, Open My Heart. You may stay seated if you'd like. For meditation, reflection, and prayer. And I offer this prayer by the Reverend Wayne B. Arneson. I invite you now into a quiet time, a time for spoken and silent contemplation. Spirit of life, we have come into each other's presence this day, seeking a part of ourselves, knowing we do not live alone, and knowing we cannot live fully if we are for ourselves alone. We gather in thanks for the life and ministry of Martin Luther King, Jr., not because we wish to worship him as a saint, but because we wish to embody his dream as a possibility that we make real. We gather with full knowledge of our shortcomings. Our lives set before us many tasks, and often we are not equal to them. We fall short of our own expectations. We find we do not know enough. We are not always patient. We fall into anger. We cannot find the strength. We lack the vision. We wait in vain for wisdom. It is painful to acknowledge our shortcomings. Yet we are here, Spirit of Life. We are here. Not always perfect, not always wise, not always just, but wonderfully and mysteriously human and alive. We dedicate this time together to renewing our hope. May the stories we share give us courage. May the songs we sing give us hope. May the words we speak give us wisdom. And most of all, may the touch of hands, the sight of faces and eyes, the sounds of voices lifted in song and affirmation restore in us faith that this world may be made whole and all its people one. Amen. Let us spend some moments in silence, meditation, or prayer, as is your, or reflection, as is your tradition. We shall now hear "We Shall Overcome," which was one of the great songs of the civil rights movement, with Spencer and Kara.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
"We Shall Overcome" was first sung in the early 1940s as a organizing song for tobacco workers in Virginia and the Carolinas. As many of us know, it became a rallying cry during the civil rights movement. And in my lifetime, I learned it when I was 12 or 13 years old, and it carried me through organizing anti-war protests. It was sung by, I heard it sung or joined in singing, a couple hundred thousand people at the November Moratorium in 1969. And again, during all of the campus unrest in 1970 following the invasion of Cambodia. So it's carried me through my life. It is a song of militancy and community building. And we shall overcome. Please join. Please rise and join us.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall.
We have two more readings this morning. The first is by Jabari S. Jones. One thing I've learned is that at the core of white privilege is the entitlement to amnesia and ignorance. To forget that America was founded on stolen land, stolen labor, and genocide, and that we live in a society structured by this history, is to embrace an identity rooted in a false innocence and a flight from truth and healing. This is the rot at the root of the nation. And then from Leslie Jameson. Empathy isn't just remembering to say, oh, that must be really hard. It's figuring out how to bring difficulty into the light so that it can be seen at all. Empathy means acknowledging a horizon of context that extends perpetually beyond what you can see.
So we gathered on Martin Luther King weekend this Sunday as our Unitarian Universalists all across the nation. We gathered to remember what MLK Jr. symbolizes and recommit to continuing the work that civil rights activists committed to in the 1950s and 1960s. And that is the work that they continued from their ancestors, the work of ending racism and oppression. It took generations to build, and it will take generations to heal. I have been very impressed by WOOF. We have gathered to learn and transform racism. People have showed up for Waking Up White, nearly 50 people, a couple of years ago, for All in the Soup conversations where we gathered after service before in the days before COVID. We had a workshop on privilege this fall. Sometimes up to 30 people in this congregation, which I will tell you is remarkable, have shown up to say, I want to understand more. This isn't okay for me, with me. I want to transform this. Last spring, we passed a version of the Eighth Principle committing to dismantle racism and systems of oppression within our congregation and outside. Most of us would really like racism and other oppressions to end. But exactly what to do and how to do it often feels vague and out of reach. If we are white, it is easy to fall to ranting or shaking our heads or shrugging. The LA police killed two black men and one Latino man the first week of January. Two were unarmed. One just had a sharp metal item. Another, one of them was having a mental health crisis. People rose in the streets after George Floyd's murder, and here we are. Many of the changes to policing promised after Floyd's murder never happened. Here we are.
This is the steady work of generations. If we are white and progressive and interact primarily with other white progressive people, it's easy to let the struggle against racism disappear and to take a break from it. We can be hopeful or not that the socioeconomic status of people of color will rise, that we will stop imprisoning so many black people, and that race isn't one of the determining factors on whether you will die of COVID or not. But for most white people, there is rarely something pressing on us that moves racial justice to the top of our to-do list. If you are a person of color, though, it is every day. It is always there. One can rarely take a break. For any people of color here this morning, I want to recognize that. I want to recognize how difficult and unfair that is. Tara Brach, meditation teacher and writer, described swimming to an island in a river one day. The swim across was easy. The trip back was, her form was really good, and when she got there, she just felt great and invigorated. But the trip back was nothing like that. It was long and arduous. She swam clumsily. She was exhausted, thirsty, and aching when she arrived back at shore. It was the current. It had virtually carried her to the island, but she had to fight it all the way back. That, she said, is the difference between being white and a person of color in the United States. Our culture was and is set up to make it harder for the majority of people of color to make their way. It was set up that way. Our country began with white colonizers murdering indigenous people and stealing their land. Then the colonizers, in a desperate need for cheap labor to plant tin and harvest that land and make it profitable, kidnapped African people and enslaved them. The colonizers created a country with laws and with a culture that made it perfectly legal and morally fine to do those things. And we are still unraveling that culture. Having cheap labor and a caste system with an undercaste still benefits too many people. The black activist Kimberly Joan explains the situation for people of color using the game of Monopoly. And I've expanded a little bit on her example here. So consider, you have a Monopoly board, and every time you go around the board is 1 year. So the first 250 times around the board, all the white people playing get all the land and all the money. And any wealth that the people of color manage to pick up through their labor or effort is just given to the white people. That's the first 250 years. For the next 125 years, the people of color get $1 when they pass go and permission to buy the land just in that first row, you know, Baltic, Mediterranean, Vermont, nice to have, but you're not going to win the game. For those 125 years, there was some additional rules. So, like, if people of color at any point manage to put enough economic crumbs together to buy land or start a business, get a hotel, the white players would just burn up the land, take the money, run them out of town, or if they wanted to, just kill them. No consequences. This is not really an exaggeration of the situation. So in the 55 rounds since the civil rights movement, people of color do get a little more money when they pass go. It's true. And they can now buy land, theoretically, anywhere on the board. It's not laws against it, anyway. Killing is still allowed, though, if the killer says they were afraid of the person of color. And wage theft is still fine. And there is a new rule, which we added in the 80s. If you are a black man, on every third turn, you roll the dice to see if you have to go to jail. If you go to jail, your passing go money will again be reduced to $1 because if you have a felony, you can't really get work or housing or funding for college or any financing at all. And this is caused almost entirely by the war on drugs and policing that focuses on black drug use and pretty much ignores white drug use. The game is completely rigged. The people who own the best land with the best businesses make the rules in order to keep their wealth.
That's how it is in the United States. If you are a person of color, you are much more likely than white people to be poor, lack access to health care and education, die of COVID, be shot by the police, and go to prison. And it's all because the game is completely rigged. That's systemic racism. Systemic racism is all the histories, laws, and policies that make it so much more difficult if you are a person of color to have the same standard of living and the same opportunities as people who are white. Systemic racism is financing education through property taxes. So children in poor, segregated neighborhoods go to substandard schools. It is transit policies that don't service black and brown neighborhoods. It is bought freeways and polluting industries placed in black and brown neighborhoods, destroying the neighborhoods and causing chronic, devastating, death-causing illness. Systemic racism isn't just about centuries of stolen labor and land from people of color, but all those gritty things, which I say in the same paragraph, all those things I just said. Racism is brutal, and fixing it is hard. I remember reading a black activist once who said, "It is like one step forward and two steps back. It's not easy to know what to do, and it is so easy to get stuck." This is true for both white people and people of color. But white people can just do something else when the going gets really hard. That's our benefit. People of color just have to keep going in this impossible system. A society cannot enslave and steal from people with particular characteristics and believe that they are human. You have to otherize people so horrible treatment can be morally tolerated. This is actually what I think evil is, and it is a great propensity of human beings. We do this easily. And U.S. society did just that. For hundreds of years, people of color have been portrayed as inferior and dangerous, barely human. Our society created images and stories about people of color that were dismissive and ugly. And those stories, they get hardwired into our brains when we grow up in a culture. And that is exactly what they're intended to do. These stories reinforce the properness of the current system. They motivate our behavior and stories that we tell to explain what has happened. These unconscious stereotypes are called implicit bias. Resmae Menakem, an expert on trauma and the author of My Grandfather's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies, tells the story of his wife, a black woman, who was shopping at Walmart. At the exit, a Walmart employee stopped her to check the items in her cart against the sales receipt. His wife decided she wanted a drink, so bought one and sat down on the bench near the exit for a moment to enjoy it. Menakem finishes the story this way. Over the next 2 or 3 minutes, she watched as about 20 people left the store. The employee stopped to double-check the receipts of all 8 of the black customers who walked past, and none of the non-black ones. Understandably, my wife was not happy about this, and she spoke to the store manager about it. The manager, who was white, was aghast. He immediately called over the employee, who was also white, and confronted her. She was apologetic, surprised, and a bit mortified. She insisted she was not deliberately targeting black customers, but only checking people randomly. Menakem's wife told him she seemed completely sincere. I believe that's what she genuinely thought she was doing. The employee's actions were unconscious. Often good people, people without any racist feelings or thoughts, act out of deeply ingrained stereotypes. Of course, this is horrible if you were a person of color, to always be being treated as if you're dangerous or inferior, week in, week out. It is wearing, and it is painful. A few years ago, black Harvard students started a social media campaign titled, #ITooAmHarvard. The students took pictures with signs that shared things that people said to them at Harvard. "You don't sound black. You sound smart. Why do you look like a thug? You're so lucky to be black. It's so easy to get into college. All these statements are people's real surprise that black people aren't the stereotype they have ingested growing up American. It happens inside the heads of people of color, too, and that is called internalized racism. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work helping end apartheid in South America, wrote, "When I went to Nigeria for the first time in the 1970s, I got on a plane in Lagos. Both pilots were black, something I'd never come across in South America. I grew inches in excitement. We took off, but then we hit turbulence. The first thought that occurred to me was, oh dear, there's no white person in the cockpit. Will these black guys be able to get us through this?" He continues, "The awfulness of racial oppression is so bad that it can make a child of God doubt that they're a child of God. And you project your self-hatred on others who look like you. We need to recover our sense of self-worth." Racism in America is dangerous for people of color. Stereotypes and the status quo are so ingrained in all of us that the current circumstances can often just feel normal and inevitable. Tomorrow is MLK Jr. Day. It is 55 years since he died. He is held up as a hero, as the man who ushered in racial equality. And certainly he, and not alone, all those people he worked with, who led the civil rights movement, made important strides. Legal segregation was ended. We have had a black president. We have a black Supreme Court justice. The minority leader in the House is black. There is a small but important black middle class and black professionals. There are more opportunities than there once were for people of color. At the same time, school segregation is about the same as it was during the civil rights movement. 1 in 3 black men will serve time in prison. And the voting rights bill passed in the 1960s is gone. And the bills have been passed in many states to restrict the voting rights of black people and other people of color, and also poor people. So what do we do? The first thing that we have to recognize is there's not a map. There's not a map. We don't really know exactly what to do. Lots of people have ideas and theories and paths and approaches. And that's all there is things to try. And we have to remember that this is the work of generations. It's not just us who can one day usher it in. It's one step forward and two steps back. And it's messy work with mistakes and pain and struggle. The real trick is to stay engaged. If we are white, sometimes that can be the hardest thing to do. Because white people don't have to. We're allowed to pretend that all is well. Jabari Jones says in this morning's reading, "One thing I've learned is that at the core of white privilege is the entitlement to amnesia and ignorance." Racism is twisted through everything in our society. It is devastating for people of color, but it harms white people too. Amnesia, that quiet slip into comfort and convenience, isn't really being fully alive or fully loving. Often it is a mask for guilt and anxiety, for something we hate but can't put a finger hold into resolving, and also for the knowledge that the ease of life in the white, middle, and upper classes is paid for by the struggles of people at the bottom of the economy. The culture of the colonizers closes all of our hearts and makes us all fear that we are not enough by the standards that make some people the idealized normal and everyone else as different and less than, always having to prove ourselves through productivity and being correct in certain ways. That is a trauma we've all been given. Being fully alive and fully loving means being present to what is in any moment, in any situation. That is always how we begin. It's always how we begin again. It's learning to practice the skills of empathy and compassion and staying open even when you really don't want to, because it's uncomfortable and inconvenient and feels bad. Leslie Jamison reminded us in this morning's reading that empathy isn't just remembering to say, that must be really hard. It's figuring out how to bring difficulty into the light so it can be seen by all. Empathy means acknowledging a horizon of context that extends perpetually beyond what you can see. Empathy is an emotional skill that allows us to understand someone else's experience, even if it is entirely unlike our own. Wendell Berry wrote, "We have lived our lives by the assumption that what is good for us would be good for the world. We have been wrong. We must change our lives so that it will be possible to live by the contrary assumption that what is good for the world will be good for us. And that requires that we make the effort to know the world and learn what is good for it." And this is an act of faith. We have to have faith that what makes possible more life for everyone will in fact make more life and love for us. It's a faith in the openness of love and how it transforms, instead of fear and scarcity and pulling into our own selves. It is something that you simply have to take on faith until you experience it. If it is believing truly and radically, this faith is believing truly and radically that we are all genuinely connected, and that injustice that hurts one of us hurts all of us. The colonizing culture that we've grown up in has tried to break us away from that truth, so that what we believe is, I have to take care of me, and that's the most important thing, instead of I have to take care of us, and that takes care of me. As bell hooks reminded us so beautifully in this morning's story, it is when we come inside each other that we become real to each other. When we are real to each other, the struggles that others suffer becomes our struggles as well. It's harder to set those struggles down for when we have the energy to pick them up. So what do we do now? We need to stretch wide. We need to be in relationship with people who have radically different experiences than our own. We need to let ourselves be uncomfortable and inconvenienced. We need to set aside fear and step outside what we usually do. The pain in our country is so very real. MLK Jr. did his work, and he did it well. And with his death, he passed it on to all of us. This weekend of remembrance is not about someone who did good deeds and solved big problems. This weekend is to remember all that must still be done, and that we, with open hearts, attention, and willingness to step into discomfort and uncertainty, can do our part in the creation of a just and caring society. We can blaze with the fire of commitment. please rise and we will sing hymn 1028, Fire of Commitment. It's in your teal hymnals, but the words will also be up here. You don't need your hymnal. Our benediction is from the Reverend John Alu Johnstone. We shall overcome when we can truly celebrate the diversity of contributions and talents offered by all people. We shall overcome hatred, prejudice, and oppression. When we can truly extend our hands to one another in loving acceptance, we shall overcome the past that haunts us now. Living in peace and freedom, we shall overcome the wrongs that have happened and the debts left unpaid. Let us join together in that commitment to overcome.
Carry your way, your way.